Well, greetings, Sun Sounds of Arizona listeners. I'm Roy Weinberg, and this is the Monday, January 19th, 2026 edition of the Christian Science Monitor Weekly. Before I continue, I must warn you that there are going to be background noises during this whole show because I'm recording this at home, and a neighbor is getting a new roof that takes numerous days. And the show must go on, so I'm going to record this show. Anyway, this week I'll start with the from the editor column, and then I'll read the cover story. The cover story is different today, but I'll tell you that later. And then I will read an article from the Global Currents section, and then the explainer. And then the home forum, which also has a poem. And then the monitor's view. So getting right into it, the From the Editor column is entitled A Consequential American Moment. This is written by Mark Trumbull, who is the National News Editor, and you can email him at trumbullm at csmonitor.com. And he writes, as the Monitor's reporters worked on this week's magazine with our look at the first year of Donald Trump's second term, a biblical phrase popped into my mind. Sow the wind, reap the whirlwind. This was not for any partisan reason. Across the political spectrum, Americans are grappling with a highly polarized political environment, one that includes emotional questions around everything from immigration to whether the American dream is alive and well, and if not, what can be done about it, as well as a technological revolution with artificial intelligence and ongoing upheaval in how people get and share information. Distrust of elites coincides with discomfort with rapid change. In many ways, we have created a society ripe for division and populism, and some historians say it is not surprising that in individualist and entrepreneurial America, the current version of populism includes a billionaire in the White House. This week's magazine offers both a review of the Trump presidency and a historical lens on populism, plus coverage of the United States intervention in Venezuela. As we put it together, we realized that no single article could sum up the American political landscape. On the one hand, President Trump has fulfilled public demand for a stepped-up border security and imposed a course correction on some less than popular social policy movements and instigated what many see as a needed toughening of trade relations with China. On the other hand, his approach to wielding power has been testing the rule of law, stressing the constitutional balance of powers, and altering foreign policy in a way that makes the prospect of a might makes right era. We hope our coverage collectively helps put the news of the past year in useful perspective. Mr. Trump is no ordinary politician. The whirlwind we are in is no ordinary moment in time. Our goal is to serve you with fact-based and fair-minded reporting. We're not about telling you what to think. But if we're doing our job right, Monitor articles should help you think and act, too, in the midst of the storm. And that was the From the Editor column written by Mark Trumbull, who is the National News Editor. And this week it was entitled A Consequential American Moment. And now for the cover story. There's actually two cover stories, and the first one is a collection of seven little articles written by different people. So, it's all under the heading of a consequential presidency in Washington. Trump has shaken up everything. With what effect? There is that paragraph why we wrote this. Beyond policy specifics, Donald Trump has in many ways raised the bar for how much power a president can wield unilaterally. So the first one here is by Linda Feldman, who's a staff writer. Move fast and break things. The Silicon Valley mantra aptly describes the whirlwind start to President Donald Trump's second term. The president hit the ground running last January, issuing a flurry of executive orders, including pardons for most January 6 defendants and the launch of the Department of Government Efficiency, Elon Musk's effort to slash the federal government. One year on, Mr. Musk is long gone, as is Doge, or D-O-G-E, and the impact of President Trump's ambitious and aggressive efforts to reshape policy, indeed America itself, is coming into focus. He has pushed the envelope on presidential power, issuing more executive orders in his first year back than in his entire first term. He has bypassed Congress and challenged the courts, invaded Venezuela and arrested its leader, exacted retribution on his perceived enemies, and transformed the White House itself with golden decor and a big planned ballroom. Mr. Trump's second term makes the first term look like a dress rehearsal. It's almost as if he spent his 4 years in office figuring out how much power he had and came back determined to use every bit of it. 50 years from now, will historians be calling Mr. Trump a transformational president? Or will this period ultimately seem like a lot of tumult and added up to little long-term change? Likely both. Every president leaves some sort of stamp on the office and the country. As always, the challenge is to separate the signal from the noise. Mr. Trump has made plenty of promises, or threats, that have gone nowhere, from claiming he could end Russia's war on Ukraine within 24 hours to saying he would turn the Gaza Strip into a luxury tourist destination. But in many ways, Mr. Trump has already changed the United States profoundly, including its role in the world, in ways that may have lasting impact. America's image in Europe as a steady ally has been torpedoed, as made clear in the president's new national security strategy, which lauds Europe's patriotic, i.e. nationalistic, parties. Mr. Trump's new tariff regime has upended global trade, while his crackdown on illegal immigration cut off the flow of migrants at the border. He's also shrunk and reshaped parts of the U.S. government, including eliminating diversity, equity, and inclusion as a priority. The departments and agencies that Mr. Trump gutted, such as the Education Department and the U.S. Agency for International Development, will be hard to reconstitute even if a future president wants to do so. In all this, and perhaps most important, he has reset the bar for using executive power. Previous presidents have been criticized for using executive orders and trying to act unilaterally, but he's taken it to a different level, says Matthew Dickinson, a presidential scholar at Middlebury College in Vermont. It's going to be hard to put that genie back in the bottle. In a year of upheaval, one notable aspect of Trump 2.0 has been the loyalty and stability of his team. Unlike year one of his first term, when the president rapidly cycled through top aides in key spots, including his chief of staff, press secretary, and chief political strategist, this year has seen little staff turnover. Let Trump be Trump appears to be the guiding philosophy of term two. Looking ahead, Mr. Trump's power might get a real check after the fall midterm elections if Democrats retake the House of Representatives. Signs of lame duckery are already appearing as some Republicans start pushing back on his policies and approach. Still, he has a year to go with the current Congress, and that's a lifetime in Trump time. All right, the second one here is the economy saw modest growth despite tariffs that stirred predictions of a recession. This is by Simon Montlake, a staff writer. President Trump won re-election on a promise to bring economic growth back to its pre-pandemic highs from his first term. The centerpiece of his plan was to levy higher tariffs on imported goods, thereby cutting the trade deficit, boosting U.S. manufacturing, and collecting higher revenues. In April, Mr. Trump sent the stock market into a temporary nosedive when he announced sweeping tariffs on nearly all countries, particularly penalizing nations that ran trade surpluses with the U.S. Before these quote-unquote Liberation Day tariffs, which were almost immediately paused to allow for negotiations, the administration had raised levies on China, as well as on Mexico and Canada, which are among America's largest trading partners. Subsequent deals have led to lower tariff rates for many countries, while importers have successfully sought exemptions. Still, the effective tariff rate on imported goods now averages 11.2%, up from 2.5%, according to the Tax Foundation. Inflation beats dire predictions. Economists say uncertainty over tariffs has been a drag on the economy, with annual growth projected to come in near 2% for the 2025 calendar year. But so far, predictions that Mr. Trump's tariffs would drive up inflation and send the economy into recession have not been borne out. Prices of imported goods have risen, but inflation, while above the Federal Reserve's target level, hasn't spiked. Still, the full impact may just be delayed. Many companies built up pre-tariff inventories, and gyrating tariff rates made it tricky for retailers to set prices. At the same time, there's no sign of a manufacturing renaissance. Indeed, manufacturing employment has fallen, not risen, under Mr. Trump. Some companies have announced plans to build or expand U.S. factories, but construction can take years, and in some cases, might never happen. What is certain is that tariffs are raising more revenue. The U.S. collected $195 billion in the fiscal year that ended September 30th, more than double the previous year. Based on current tariff rates, revenue could hit $247 billion in 2026, while the trade deficit has narrowed to a five-year low. But if imports fall further because of either high prices or the reshoring of manufacturing, that would result in lower tariff revenue. The Supreme Court could also upend things with a ruling on the legality of Mr. Trump's tariffs. The stock market has been strong overall, and home prices also remain high, buoying homeowners, but keeping other Americans out of the housing market. Only 21% of home buyers in 2025 were first-time buyers, a record low in tracking that goes back to 1981. Expect to hear more about affordability in the coming year. And the next one, universities faced a federal funding freeze over alleged anti-Semitism and DEI policies. Some cut deals. Harvard sued. This is by Simon Montlake, who's a staff writer. President Trump waged a sustained campaign last year against America's top universities, ostensibly over how they handled incidents of anti-Semitism during campus protests over Israel's war in Gaza. In response, some universities acknowledged shortcomings on anti-Semitism and promised steps to foster ideological diversity. Others have balked at Mr. Trump's demands as a violation of their autonomy. Harvard, one of the biggest targets, has fought back in court. Mr. Trump's efforts began last January with an executive order on combating anti-Semitism that singled out colleges and universities. Later, he moved to freeze federal research grants to several universities accused of violating anti-discrimination laws, sending a message to higher education as a whole. Conservatives argue that many colleges have become bastions of the left-wing indoctrination and are failing to properly educate the next generation. Pressing colleges to cut deals. The administration has demanded a dismantling of diversity programs on campuses and stricter enforcement of merit-based admissions. By freezing billions of dollars in grants to Harvard, Columbia, Brown, and other research universities, Mr. Trump found an effective way to pressure private universities into changing how they operate. Another pressure point is foreign students. The Trump administration has threatened to stop issuing student visas for Harvard, which enrolls large numbers of students from abroad. New international student enrollment has fallen by 17% in the current academic year amid uncertainty over visa issuance, according to the Institute of International Education. In July, Columbia paid more than $200 million to settle an anti-discrimination investigation and restart research funding. Brown, Cornell, Northwestern, and the University of Pennsylvania have also signed agreements accepting varying conditions. All have insisted that academic freedom hasn't been compromised. Harvard has pushed back on Mr. Trump's demands. It successfully argued in federal court that the administration's cuts to its research funding were unconstitutional. The case is now under appeal, while Harvard faces investigations on other fronts and demands to turn over more admissions data. Colleges also face higher taxes on endowments because of Mr. Trump's One Big Beautiful Bill from July. What had been a flat 1.4% excise tax on private colleges and universities over a certain size will become a tiered system with a top tax rate of 8%. That is aimed squarely at elite universities. And the next one here, a foreign policy about face has rebuffed longtime allies and put new focus on the Western Hemisphere. This is written by Howard LaFranchi, who is a staff writer. Last year, the world got its first real taste of what President Trump's America First foreign policy would entail. The new coins of the realm are transactionalism, tariffs, big power politics, and include bullying of allies like Canada and Israel, and, perhaps most significant, a spheres of influence vision of the world reminiscent of the 19th century. A view of the Western Hemisphere as America's exclusive zone of interest was starkly on display with a Caribbean power buildup that culminated in a January 3rd military operation in Venezuela that seized President Nicolas Maduro to face drug trafficking charges in the U.S. Out, or at least downplayed, in Mr. Trump's foreign policy playbook are the military and economic alliances and U.S.-led international institutions born from the ashes of World War II. The idea that America enhances its own prosperity and security by building and leading communities of democratic nations has been supplanted by the view that America is strong and prosperous when it puts America first. In his first term, Mr. Trump's foreign policy was hindered by a lack of preparation for implementing a radically different vision of American global leadership. But the architects of the Trump 2.0 foreign policy, including Deputy Chief of Staff Stephen Miller, had a four-year interregnum to prepare for this term's muscular, nationalist, America-centric approach. The arrival of this approach is seen in the evolution of Secretary of State Marco Rubio, as a former Trump critic has adapted his promotion of democracies and human rights to the America First vision. 2025 brought a deepening estrangement from European allies and more collegial relations with strongman leaders, from Russia's Vladimir Putin to Saudi Arabia's Mohammed bin Salman. Mr. Trump has bombed Iran's nuclear facilities, sought to use tariffs as leverage in America's rivalry with China, and spurred negotiations to end the conflicts in Gaza and Ukraine. But the road toward peace in those regions remains uncertain. The most striking application of Mr. Trump's foreign policy came in the Western Hemisphere, where his Monroe Doctrine 2.0 includes justifying the use of force in the region to secure U.S. interests. In the first weeks of his return, Mr. Trump threatened to retake the Panama Canal, spoke of acquiring Greenland, and belittled Canada as a 51st state. Then came the military strikes in the Caribbean on suspected drug smuggling boats and what the administration described as a blockade to stop sanctioned oil tankers from exporting Venezuelan oil. They put pressure on Mr. Maduro, whom Mr. Trump had already labeled a narco-terrorist. But the blockade and ultimately Mr. Maduro's capture were also seen to be directed at China, which has extensive economic and political ties across Latin America. To Beijing, the message is this: in this new age of spheres of influence, the Western Hemisphere is America's domain. And the next one here is blasting the left for weaponizing justice. Trump has responded in kind. This is written by Henry Gass, a staff writer. The first year of this second Trump administration has challenged long-standing norms in the criminal justice system. Having criticized the justice system as unfairly targeting him, Mr. Trump appears to be trying to use the system in a similar fashion. He has pushed for prosecutions of his political adversaries and issued pardons for allies. He has personally criticized lower court judges who ruled against his administration, while one of his top aides has railed against judicial tyranny. Presidents have traditionally refrained from direct criticism like this out of respect for the judiciary's independence and to uphold public confidence in the courts. Amid Mr. Trump's attacks, violent threats against federal judges rose. In September, Mr. Trump called for two adversaries, former FBI Director James Comey and New York Attorney General Letitia James, to be prosecuted. Indictments quickly followed against Mr. Comey on charges of lying to Congress and against Ms. James on charges of mortgage fraud. Both denied charges, and both cases have since been dismissed on procedural grounds. Susie Wiles, Mr. Trump's chief of staff, told Vanity Fair that the James case might be the one example of retribution. She added, I don't think he wakes up thinking about retribution, but when there's an opportunity, he will go for it. Meanwhile, Mr. Trump has used the presidential pardon power to reward his supporters and potential allies. On his first day in office, he issued pardons to more than 1,500 people convicted or charged for their participation in the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol, including hundreds charged with violent felonies. The next one. On immigration, Trump has kept pledges but stirred controversy and disapproval. This is by Sarah Matusik, who is a staff writer. In year one, President Trump oversaw an avalanche of anti-immigrant policies while creating exceptions for some immigrants who are white or rich. From borderlands to urban centers, his administration targeted illegal immigration and lawful pathways alike. He condemned many migrants generally as criminals. He called some specifically garbage. Invoking a rare wartime law and disputed gang ties, the Department of Homeland Security sent more than 100 Venezuelans to a notorious Salvadoran prison in March. A federal judge has asked the administration to address due process violations while the government dismisses former detainees' claims of abuse. The president kept campaign promises as he sought to seal the southern border. Border Patrol apprehensions, a proxy for illegal crossings, sank to their lowest level since 1970. A surge of armed forces to the border included the creation of new military zones. In the interior, controversial waves of immigrant arrests, many targeting people without criminal records, at times ensnared U.S. citizens. Even as the administration withholds certain data, it reports deporting over 600,000 people. Mr. Trump also limited legal immigration, including of refugees, while prioritizing Afrikaners from South Africa. As foreigners from 39 countries face entry bans, Mr. Trump is offering gold card residency for $1 million per person. Heading into year two, polling suggests the public has soured on his immigration agenda. What to watch? Whether the Supreme Court lets the president end the constitutional guarantee of birthright citizenship. And the next one, on race and gender, a White House reversal of liberal policies spans from government contracts to school sports. This is by Story Hickley, who is a staff writer. President Trump has taken a number of steps in office aimed at defeating woke, that's in quotes, ideology, including dismantling diversity, equity, and inclusion, or DEI, programs that he said illegally discriminated against white people. On his first day in office, Mr. Trump signed an executive order instructing government agencies and departments to terminate all DEI offices and positions, equity action plans, and DEI performance requirements. A direct answer to Biden actions. This order was a direct response to the first executive order President Joe Biden signed after his own inauguration, instructing agency heads to assess the equity of agency policies and actions. Another Trump executive order rescinded affirmative action requirements for federal contractors. U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi issued a memo instructing the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division to investigate illegal DEI mandates in the private sector and in educational institutions that receive federal funds. Shifts at U.S. corporations. In response, major U.S. companies from Walmart to Meta scrapped diversity goals and training programs, and hundreds of colleges and universities have ended programs that promoted DEI on campus or focused on LGBTQ+ or minority students. Mr. Trump moved to undo protections for transgender people, making it federal policy to only recognize two genders and rescinding federal funds from schools that allow biological males to compete in women's sports. After Mr. Trump revoked Mr. Biden's executive order that allowed transgender troops to serve openly in the military, the Department of Defense issued a ban on transgender service members, which the Supreme Court has upheld. His Department of Health and Human Services in December proposed a sweeping set of new rules that would dramatically restrict access to gender transition treatments for minors. Mr. Trump has also tried to shift American culture in a more conservative direction. He has instructed the Smithsonian Museums to root out what he calls anti-American propaganda in their exhibits. He took over the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts, appointing a new board that tapped him as its chair, eliminating woke programming and adding his name to the building's exterior. And here is, I believe, the last one. Yes, sir. And it's entitled, A Doge Called Caused Turmoil But Didn't Save Nearly As Much Taxpayer Money As Promised. This is by Story Hinckley, a staff writer. Remaking the federal bureaucracy began on Trump's first day in office when he created the Department of Government Efficiency. Under the leadership of Mr. Trump's billionaire benefactor Elon Musk, Doge became synonymous with the president's effort to dislodge what he calls the deep state and slash a bloated federal government. Mr. Musk set a goal of cutting $2 trillion from the country's $7 trillion budget. By its own account, Doge, which disbanded 8 months ahead of schedule, only achieved about 10% of its cost-cutting goal. Media investigations and conservative think tanks suggest the true savings were roughly half that at best. Still, cuts were widespread across the government. The U.S. Agency for International Development was shuttered entirely, and the Education Department saw its workforce cut by almost 50%. The Departments of Defense, Treasury, and Agriculture each lost at least 20,000 employees. Doge's total impact on government staffing remains unclear, however, in part because of rehires, court-mandated or otherwise. The Office of Personnel Management says it achieved Mr. Trump's goal of 4 reductions for every new hire. With 317,000 employees leaving the federal government in 2025 and 68,000 new ones joining. But Rachel Augustine Potter, a politics professor at the University of Virginia, who has looked closely at available data, puts the total workforce reduction at less than 6%, going from 2.27 million workers to 2.14 million. Either estimate is modest compared with President Bill Clinton's federal workforce cut of about 17% in the 1990s. Laid-off federal workers have described last year as traumatic, while some who are still employed say the turmoil has undermined their ability to do their job. Many workers with private sector opportunities took buyouts, leading to a draining of strong employees. That, along with the administration's undermining of federal workers, may damage future recruitment. Mr. Trump also signed executive orders to allow for more politically appointed positions, a sharp departure, Dr. Potter says, from the meritocratic foundations of the U.S. bureaucracy. If courts uphold these changes, she writes, it could make it difficult for America to return to a less politicized, expertise-based civil service. You are listening to the Christian Science Monitor Weekly with Roy Weinberg on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Well, that was certainly a long article, and we are not done. There still is one more cover story, but associated with the first one, there is a long timeline entitled Key Events in the First Year of the President's Second Term. They are color-coded, but I'm not going to bother telling you what they are, because we'll probably take another 45 minutes to do this. So, the shorthand version is just the events. January 20th, takes oath of office. January 20th, expands border enforcement. January 20th, pardons defendants and January 6th, attacked. January 24th, reinstates global anti-abortion stance. January 28th, invites federal employees to voluntarily resign. January 28th, order seeks to end transgender treatment for children. January 28th, mandates federal return to offices. January 29th, signs Laken-Riley Act on immigrant crime. February 4th, places most USAID workers on leave. February 5th, pushes schools to keep men out of women's sports. February 7th, plans to chair Kennedy Center himself. February 10th, calls to drop corruption charges against New York Mayor Eric Adams. March 1st, declares English the official language. March 6th, announces a crypto strategic reserve. March 12th, applies 25% tariff on steel and aluminum. March 15th, orders airstrikes against Houthi-controlled Yemen. March 15th, deports alleged gang members to prison in El Salvador. March 18th, fires two Federal Trade Commission members. March 18th, Chief Justice rebukes Trump's call for a judge's impeachment. March 25th, ends parole program for Cubans, Haitians, Nicaraguans, and Venezuelans. March 25th, calls for proof of citizenship to vote. March 26th, announces 25% tariff on foreign car imports. April 2nd, announces 10% global Liberation Day tariffs. Will go higher for many nations. May 1st, funding cuts for NPR and PBS. May 8th, transgender people declared unfit for military service. May 19th, signs the Take It Down Act regarding online sexual images. May 28th, Elon Musk exit role as Doge head. June 7th, deploys National Guard troops over LA protests. June 14th, military parade in D.C. June 14th, No Kings anti-Trump protests. June 20th, announces Congo-Rwanda peace treaty. June 21st, strikes Iran nuclear sites. June 25th, at NATO summit, Europeans commit to raising defense spending. And July 4th, signs One Big Beautiful Bill Act with tax and spending cuts. July 9th, gets Texas Republicans to pursue partisan redistricting. July 14th, Supreme Court allows Education Department layoffs. July 18th, signs Cryptocurrency Genius Act. July 23rd, $221 million settlement by Columbia University. August 1st, fires labor statistics chief after weak jobs report. August 7th, launches federal role in D.C. policing. He took a break all the way till August 22nd. U.S. takes 10% stake in chip maker Intel. August 29th, cancels $4.9 billion in foreign aid authorized by Congress. September 2nd, first lethal strike in a campaign against alleged drug boats from South America. September 21st, attends Charlie Kirk Memorial. September 23rd, addresses UN General Assembly. September 25th, indicts former FBI Director James Comey, alleging false statements and obstruction. September 30th, Doge job cuts during 2025 may total about 300,000. October 3rd, $1 coin design bears President Trump's likeness. October 3rd, Hamas agrees to parts of Trump peace proposal. October 9th, $20 billion bailout for Argentina. October 9th, indicts New York Attorney General Letitia James, alleging mortgage fraud. October 16th, former security advisor John Bolton indicted over classified data. October 16th, Chamber of Commerce sues administration over H-1B worker visa fees. October 18th, second No Kings protests. October 20th, demolition of the East Wing for a White House ballroom. And there's still more. October 30th, refugee cap of 7,500 for 2026, lowest on record. November 10th, U.S. skips global climate conference for first time. November 12th, budget bill ends record government shutdown, 43 days. November 12th, Mint ends penny production. November 20th, they've got proposes expansion of offshore drilling, and then they backtrack to November 17th here. International student enrollment drops. November 24th, Maduro regime named a foreign terrorist organization. November 26th, 2020 election racketeering case against Trump dismissed in Georgia. December 1st, pardons former Honduran president, freed from U.S. prison. December 8th, promises $12 billion in aid to farmers hurt by the trade war. December 10th, seizes an oil tanker in Venezuela conflict. December 10th, gold card website, $1 million for legal status in U.S. December 11th, plans to sue states that regulate AI. January 3rd, captures indicted Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro. There you go, quite the accomplishments. Now here is our second cover story. America's new populist moment. Trump's populism is not the first to challenge the U.S. status quo. This is written by Marshall Ingwersen, who is a special contributor, and I'm looking for that paragraph that says why we wrote this, and guess what? There isn't one. So, here we go. In many ways, America has been here before. At the opening of the 20th century, a Nebraska lawyer named William Jennings Bryan drew crowds totaling millions as he traveled around the country railing against East Coast elites. It was the tail end of the Gilded Age, a time when the country's prosperity was booming, but the lived experience of workers diverged dramatically from the bankers and railroad barons whose lifestyles grew ever more opulent. Bryan broke all the sedate norms of political campaigns, inventing the whistle-stop tour to speak directly to the public, not the press, and with the emotional force of a religious revival. This was the previous peak in American populism, and it launched decades of lasting change. Bryan earned the Democratic presidential nomination three times, never winning the office. But his agenda thrived. He promoted many once extreme ideas that eventually became law, including the progressive income tax and the election of U.S. senators directly by voters rather than having state legislatures choose them. Many of his radical demands became the mainstream reforms of the progressive movement in the early 20th century. Populism is a battle cry that has once again risen to a high pitch in America, and President Donald Trump is the undisputed master of the modern populist style, with perfect pitch for the grievances that are driving it. Populism is a recurring template that casts corrupt, greedy elites against wholesome, hardworking common people. It usually involves a strong personal leader. It is also polarized and polarizing. Us against them. Populist stances are framed as a crusade of good versus evil, not as a practical negotiation of win-win policy outcomes. It's a zero-sum game. When someone wins, someone else loses. At its most effective, populism can shake a nation awake to concerns that elites often thought were settled or didn't even perceive as problems, such as a sense of being left behind by the economy or feeling like a backward stranger in your own culture. At its most risky, populism can unravel institutions from the rule of law to international alliances. That can take generations to rebuild. This is the populist path of President Andrew Jackson, who fired thousands of federal employees and handed out their jobs to allies and supporters. "To the victor go the spoils," were the words by which Jackson governed. It took more than 50 years before lawmakers restored a merit-based system for civil servants. Jackson also closed down the nation's central bank, leading to nearly 80 years of high volatility and frequent financial panics until Woodrow Wilson created the Federal Reserve in 1913. During his Christmas address, Mr. Trump sounded what might have been one of the most starkly populist holiday greetings in recent memory. "For the last 4 years," he said, "the United States was ruled by politicians who fought only for insiders, illegal aliens, career criminals, corporate lobbyists, prisoners, terrorists, and above all, foreign nations, which took advantage of us at levels never seen before. Now you have a president who fights for the law-abiding, hard-working people of our country, the ones who make the nation run." Unlikely times for populism? On the surface, these seem like unlikely times for populism to flourish in America. The country remains at the pinnacle of global wealth and power. The past decade has had the lowest average joblessness, even with the pandemic spike, of any decade over the last 50 years. Inflation has been at or below a modest 3% for nearly 2 years. The median wage has been rising faster than the overall cost of living. And the net worth of the average millennial, even after adjusting for inflation, is higher than that of their parents or grandparents at the same age. Not exactly the stuff revolutions are made of. Even as millions of jobs were created over the past decade, the total number of jobs that don't require a college degree has dropped by 1.2 million. Non-college educated young people are seeing their opportunities narrow. They also see the rising population of tech bros and hedge fund billionaires. For 90% of Americans, income inequality has held its own since the early 2000s. The poorest, in particular, have made stronger gains than other income groups. But in that time, the top 0.1% has doubled its already stratospheric share of national income. The very, very rich are pulling even further away from the field. Rising housing costs don't much affect the millions of families who already own a house but have a low mortgage rate. But over the past two decades, the price of the median house in America has risen more than 50% and the average mortgage rates by even more. Many well-paid young people don't see how they can ever climb those barriers to home ownership. A recent National Association of Realtors survey put the average age of a first-time homebuyer at 40. 10 years ago, it was 31. That's in part a sign of young people delaying getting married and starting a family, but it might also be a reason for the delay. Many young people feel that life is not quite working out the way it did for their baby boomer or Generation X parents. In the heyday of American optimism, President John F. Kennedy is often credited with delivering the famous phrase that captured the all-in-it-together worldview of egalitarian growth: a rising tide lifts all boats. That worldview has since lost ground. A recent study of more than 20,000 Americans found it being increasingly displaced by a zero-sum mindset of limited good. This assumption or fear that gains for one group come at the expense of others is more dominant among young adults than for older generations and is stronger among Democrats than Republicans. It tends to be a low trust perspective, and social trust, especially trust in institutions, has been falling since the 1960s. These outlooks are tied further to a sense of grievance or unfairness. The latest global report from the Edelman Trust Barometer finds that a sense of grievance now shapes the worldview in 6 in 10 people across 26 countries. Those with a high sense of grievance are more likely to hold a zero-sum mindset towards people with different politics, with 53% saying others' gains come at their expense compared with only 23% with low grievance. The grievances, no doubt, are varied, but many Americans feel left out of the nation's general prosperity. Left behind. At the extreme of disconnection from society, a Financial Times analysis of U.S. Census data found that nearly 1 in 10 young adults between the ages of 20 and 24 are not in a job, not seeking work, not in school, and not raising a child. That number is 50% higher than 25 years ago. The feeling of being left behind is even stronger among rural white Americans. Arlie Russell Hochschild, a sociologist, spent 5 years in the early 2000s talking to working-class white Tea Party supporters in rural Louisiana for her book, Strangers in Their Own Land. She described people who felt like they were waiting in a long, slow-moving line to get to the American dream, but the liberal elites who control the line keep letting so-called marginalized groups cut it in ahead of them. They felt cheated. Left-wing populism is also finding traction, especially among younger Americans. The victory of Democratic Socialist Zoran Mandami in the New York City mayoral election points to this. What it might continue to sound like, every billionaire is a policy failure, a slogan coined by an aide to Democratic Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York, implying that such concentrated wealth could and should be spread to others. But populism is being driven by more than economics. American culture has moved considerably left in recent decades. Whether one dismisses Mr. Trump's MAGA movement as a foggy nostalgia for an American before the Beatles, or sees an invigorating return to Western civilization's first principles, many want a course correction. Few Americans want to roll back the major benchmarks of inclusivity. Support for interracial marriage, for instance, is virtually universal among Americans at 94 to 96%. In 1958, it was 4%. Women are now well over 50% of the graduates of law and medical schools, 10 times the share in 1960. Strong majorities support the outcome of more women becoming doctors and lawyers. But there is an argument that the Progressive March overshot the national consensus, and it rolled on largely outside of political process, driven instead by court decisions, executive orders, or policymakers in public and private institutions. The rights that feel most settled in the minds of Americans are those that went through the grueling political process of legislation. Rights established primarily through the courts, such as abortion or, to a lesser extent, affirmative action, are often viewed by opponents as undemocratic, handed down by elites. The Civil Rights Act of 1964, for instance, was hard-fought legislation. It outlawed racial segregation and discrimination, and eventually Americans widely came to accept its ideals of equality. But majorities have never supported racial preferences over other race-conscious remedies for past discrimination, much less the algebra is white supremacy level of racial doctrine. Whatever their merits, few of these went through a process that involved voting. The long march of women's rights involved a rich mix of legislative battles, including Title IX, establishing gender equity in education, and court victories. Same-sex marriage was established largely in court but affirmed in 2022 by national legislation. It enjoys strong majority support today. On the other hand, hot-button transgender issues such as trans women playing on women's sports teams or medically transitioning minors have not been subject to political process and have drawn major pushback. Vast majorities of Americans also hold positive views of immigrants and their contribution to society. Equally high majorities say immigration was too high and too uncontrolled before Mr. Trump took office. Legislative action regarding immigration has been stymied for the past 35 years, leaving policy to executive orders. Populism as a corrective. In surfacing these issues, populism can be something of a corrective to liberal democracy. Kaz Murray, a leading expert on populism and a political scientist at the University of Georgia, calls populism an illiberal democratic response to undemocratic liberalism. In other words, when judges, experts, or other elites decide issues from the courts or the bureaucracy, that is essentially undemocratic, even in a representative democracy such as America's, where voters at times face the frustration that simple majorities can't dictate outcomes. The populist response is emotion-driven pushback that is often illiberal, unconcerned, or even antagonistic to checks and balances, the rule of law, or the rights of minorities. As Dr. Muddy explains, populists don't have political opponents, they have enemies. By tapping into these grievances, Mr. Trump is breaking the norms of political behavior. It's his defining signature as a public figure. Historically, though, his violations are neither the first nor the worst. Franklin D. Roosevelt was the first president to violate the sacred tradition of the two-term limit, winning election four times. He also attempted to expand the Supreme Court by as many as six seats to create majority support for his programs. Jackson blatantly ignored a major Supreme Court decision leading to the Trail of Tears as Native American tribes were ousted from southeastern U.S. Richard Nixon secretly used the IRS to harass people on his enemies list. And President Trump's norm-breaking might be as thrilling a counterattack on the deep state and undemocratic liberalism for some of it as it is terrifying to those who fear for the very structure of American democracy under unchecked presidential power. Mr. Trump's populist style seems to be intuitive rather than studied or acquired, but it also could have come directly from the populist playbook of Saul Alinsky, a 1960s left-wing community organizer who dubbed himself the Machiavelli of the poor. He wrote Rules for Radicals and How to Crack Loose the Grip of the Wealthy and Powerful by Violating the Polite Norms of Civility and Order. Mr. Alinsky's rule number 5, ridicule is man's most potent weapon. There is no defense. Rule 13, pick the target, freeze it, personalize it, and polarize it. When economic growth was slipping last year, Mr. Trump laid blame on the Federal Reserve by targeting Board Chairman Jerome Powell, a Trump appointee, calling him a numbskull and a Trump hater and Mr. Too Late. As affordability concerns continue to rise, Mr. Trump has kept Mr. Powell front and center. When the Fed makes a mistake that costs people their homes, they shouldn't be able to hide behind a title. We need a chairman who listens to the people, not just the spreadsheets, the president wrote in a December social media post. But Mr. Linsky also had a Rule 12. The price of a successful attack is a constructive alternative. Populism is about the battle. Governing is about delivering growth and progress that people feel includes them. It's hard, slow work that must ultimately bring people together, and it's happening all the time. And Marshall Ingerson, who wrote this, was editor of the Monitor from 2014 to 2017. Well, that certainly was a long collection of stories under the heading of the cover story. We only got 7 minutes left, actually less than that, so I'm going to skip the articles from the Global Currents, and I'll go straight to the explainer. So, it's entitled, What's for Dinner? If it's beef, it'll cost you. And there's that article, why we wrote this. Eye-popping prices for steaks and burgers are mostly a supply problem, exacerbated by lack of competition in the meatpacking industry. The upshot is that beef is likely to remain expensive for a while. And this is written by Simon Montlake, who is a staff writer. If you have served roast beef for dinner lately, you no doubt experienced sticker shock at the grocery store. The same goes for steaks and hamburgers as beef prices hit record highs recently in the United States, rattling President Donald Trump, who has vowed to bring prices down. The average price for ground beef hit $6.30 a pound in September, up from $5.50 at the start of 2025, an increase of almost 15%. As recently as May 2023, ground beef retailed for less than $5 a pound. Steak prices have risen even more sharply in recent months. Higher beef prices are squeezing margins at restaurant chains and have been reluctant to raise prices. Mr. Trump signed an executive order on December 6th to examine anti-competitive behavior in food supply chains, including beef production. The Justice Department also began an antitrust investigation into meatpacking companies. Polling shows that voters upset about the cost of beef and other everyday items have soured on Mr. Trump's economic management, even as he claims that he has crushed inflation that spiked under President Joe Biden. They caused the high prices and we're bringing them down, he said in a speech in Pennsylvania on December 9th, referring to Democrats. A report from the Bureau of Labor Statistics showed inflation at 2.7% for November, above the Federal Reserve's target of 2%. Some ranchers are complaining about Mr. Trump's trade policies, including his agreement to quadruple beef imports from Argentina and his on-off tariffs on Brazilian beef. The rollback of specific tariffs has been aimed at bringing down consumer prices. The Brazilian tariff relief includes coffee, the price of which was up 41% in September compared with the previous year. But most of the 28 billion pounds of beef consumed annually in the U.S., especially cuts of steak and roasts, is domestically produced. Experts say the price of beef depends less on tweaks to the administration's trade policy and more on lack of competition in industry, which is a much knottier problem to fix, and one that has eluded previous administrations. The upshot is that beef prices are likely to stay high for a while. And now what follows is a question and answer piece. Question, why are beef prices so high? Answer, simply put, it's about a lack of supply. The number of cattle being raised for slaughter in the U.S. has fallen to the lowest level since the 1950s. Ranchers cut their herds during and after the pandemic amid prolonged droughts in states such as Texas and higher feedstock costs. The total herd of beef cattle was 28.7 million in July, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Beef producers can't respond to higher prices as quickly as consumers may wish, since it takes around 2 years for a newborn calf to reach maturity. I expect prices are going to remain high until we start producing more cows, says James McDonald, a research professor at the University of Maryland's College of Agriculture and Natural Resources. It takes a long time to rebuild herds. The suspension of Mexican cattle imports in May after an outbreak of screwworm has further restricted supply. Reopening the border to Mexican cattle would boost supply, but would be risky unless the parasite is contained, says Professor McDonald. As U.S. beef production drops, The industry has been trying to produce more beef from the cattle it slaughters. By historic standards, we're still producing a lot of beef. We're just doing it with fewer cows. Glenn Tonser, a professor of agricultural economics at Kansas State University, told NPR. Demand for beef has largely held up despite higher prices. Per capita consumption is forecast at 58.5 pounds for 2025, according to the USDA, down slightly from 2024. Question: what is the Trump administration doing about the issue? Answer: Mr. Trump has asked his senior advisors to find more policy levers he can pull to bring down beef prices. The Wall Street Journal reported, he has consulted with trade organizations, governors of farm states, and the meat industry. His executive order directs the Justice Department and the Federal Trade Commission to examine competition in U.S. food supply chains. Ranchers, consumer groups, and farm state lawmakers have complained for years about anti-competitive practices in beef processing. Four processors dominate the industry: Tyson Foods, Cargill, and two Brazil-based companies, JBS and Marfrig Global Foods. Together, they slaughter around 85% of grain, fat, and cattle in the U.S. In November, Mr. Trump alleged on social media, without providing details, that foreign-owned meat packers were colluding to manipulate U.S. beef prices. During his first administration, the Justice Department opened an investigation into the beef industry that continued into the Biden administration. That probe recently ended, but a new one has begun in potential anti-competitive behavior, according to the Wall Street Journal. Responding to Mr. Trump's social media post, an industry group said in a statement that beef packers have been operating at a loss for the last year due to tight cattle supply. U.S. beef processors welcome a fact-based discussion about beef affordability and how best to meet the needs of American consumers, who are the industry's most important stakeholders, Meat Institute President and CEO Julie Anna Potts said. Well, by looking at the old clock on the wall, I can see that we are at the conclusion of this week's Christian Science Monitor Weekly program. This is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster, Roy Weinberg. Thank you for joining me this week, and stay tuned to Sun Sounds of Arizona.